Hey folks, welcome back to TWIP. This is episode 512. Hopefully you can hear me now. This is a pretty exciting episode tonight. We're going to be talking about the business of photography, and I'm joined by two of my really good friends, Mr. Matt Granger and Ms. Valerie Jardin. They're going to be talking about their individual experiences when it comes to generating a buck with your camera. All that's coming your way next on TWIP episode 512.
This is TWIP.
All right, here we are back with episode 512. I'm joined by Mr. Matt Granger and Ms. Valerie Jardin. We're all over the country right now, all coming together on This Week in Photo to talk about the business of photography. You guys, I haven't spoken to either one of you in forever, so let's do some quick introductions. Valerie, what is going on? Where are you at in the world right now?
I'm between Paris and Rome, and I'm in Minneapolis. That's how I kind of measure my life. You know, this happened between such city and such city, because that's kind of like the rhythm of my year. So I'm in Minneapolis. That's home base at the moment still. Just back from Paris and a week vacation in Normandy and heading to Rome next.
You know, every time I talk to you, I just feel increasingly bad about myself.
Hey, you came to Paris once.
I did. We hung out in Paris, and that was an adventure. Thank you for that. That was amazing. Matt Granger, you recently, I don't know if it's recent now, but within the last couple of years, you relocated from down under to New York City. Is that where you are right now?
Yes, I'm now, I moved to Manhattan, but now I'm across the river in Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn, nice. Okay, so what's going on with you? So what's the latest in the Matt Granger travel schedule? Last I heard, I was watching a video and you were in Tokyo and you had just popped out of Ethiopia or something. Like, you are always crisscrossing the globe. What's going on?
Yeah, I am. Wow, you're really keeping tabs.
I'm a stalker, man. Come on.
Ethiopia for a couple of weeks, Japan for a couple of weeks, Hong Kong for 4 or 5 days, plus one, thanks to the storms. But now I'm back here for, a couple of weeks, then Vegas, Laos, back here, Hawaii, Iceland, back here.
See, that was a perfect segue, because that's partly what I want to talk about, and that's that lifestyle that both of you guys live this lifestyle in different kinds of ways. Valerie, you're a mom and a wife, and you have a house in Minneapolis, and you're doing that thing, plus you find the time to run off to Paris and teach people how to be Cartier-Bresson, right?
And come back and leave again.
You have a kid who's going to be like running the world. I mean, you're like doing all this stuff. Valerie, let's start with you. First of all, you know, you guys have the list of things I want to talk about, but I want to talk about time management first. And, you know, juggling all of those balls successfully. How do you keep them in the air, and how do you manage the bookkeeping, the scheduling, booking, you know, people to come on your trips and all that stuff? How does it, you have another Valerie in there somewhere? Like, how do you do that?
No, and actually until very recently, it was really a solo endeavor. And I just hired an assistant to take care of some of the office stuff, especially when I'm traveling.
Yeah.
I've done it all my own, and everybody thinks that, you know, I have several people working for me, but it's real. Well, you know how hard it is to let go of stuff. And when you're a solo entrepreneur, you're so quick at doing things. And it's like, okay, well, I could answer this email, or I could send it to someone with directions of what to say, which is going to take longer than answering it myself. So forever you do it yourself. And now I don't. Unless it's a client that has a question on a workshop and I'm pretty much the only one who can answer it, I'm sending it to my assistant and said, okay, this is what I want you to answer. Yes, it takes just as long, but if I don't start doing that, I never will. And it's so liberating now to just know that. It's part of the training too.
Absolutely. And that what you just said, that is the curse. And Matt, I want to hear from you on that too, but that seems like that's the curse of the entrepreneur. And that's the letting go piece. And I hear from you know, I'm always learning stuff and reading and watching videos and all this, and it seems like that the line between really successful people and people that are trying to get there is the ability to let go and offload stuff to other people. Do you agree with that, Matt?
Definitely. I have to round of applause for Valerie. I still find that so difficult. I have to apologize to the people who've applied. I must have advertised the job 3 times and not even gotten to interview stage because I couldn't go through the applications. I didn't have the time. And exactly what you said, finding, training someone and finding the time to invest, to get that person up and running, to later save you time. You know, I'm sure all of us are regularly doing 12 and 14 hour days. So finding the extra time to do it when I know how to do it right now.
Yeah.
It's really difficult.
Yeah.
And part of it is letting go, but part of it is also, you know, finding the balance of time and income and all of that stuff when you're, you know, I think it's easy to think of photography as any creative business as something really unique, but we really, I think, face the same issues as any small business, except it's harder to scale when your name's on the banner.
Yeah, that, and you hit it right on the head. If you were just working for someone else and the work product or the reputation wasn't tied to your brand or your name that you've slaved for decades to build, then it'd be easier to let go. But when it's tied to you, then it's hard to let go. And then the next question becomes, like, Valerie, you know, you managed to find the unicorn to help you with this stuff. Matt, you've seen how hard it is. How do you find people to help you that you trust to offload and take command of your brand? Like, how did you find your assistant, Valerie?
I've met her at conferences and such. So she knows the business. She also knows the photography industry. So that was really important to me, and to be someone that I actually met in person versus getting a virtual assistant, you know, out of, you know, who knows where. Granted, the different time zone can be beneficial. You can have somebody on the other end of the world that works out great, and it's nice sometimes to have things happen while you're sleeping, if you find the time to sleep, that is. But she's on the East Coast, so it's nice because we can communicate during the day, and it's been helpful, and we've met several times.
Yeah, so the part of that key would be actually shaking hands in person versus trying to do the digital.
It's such a big deal. I mean, it's my brand, and having somebody answer speaking engagement requests for you and things like that, you really have to trust that person.
Yeah. And Matt, what about you? You've been unsuccessful finding someone to help. So what was your process for putting the feeler out? Did you just mention on one of your broadcasts, or did you send out an email? What was that flow?
No, to be honest, I don't know. I think that trying to recruit a fan to do that stuff, for me anyway, would be a problem. I need someone who can actually do the job, not someone well-meaning. It's like someone wanting to assist to learn by osmosis. It's so often more trouble than it's worth. You know, you don't pay someone, you can't expect anything, you know, so right.
You get what you pay
finding
for.
Someone who, you know, it sounds like you've found someone great there, Val, who knows the industry is the hardest thing. I don't think there's a formula for it, or if there is, I haven't cracked it. Each time I'm moving and each area of the business I'm trying to bring someone on, I'm just trying to figure it out as I go, to be honest. I've just gotten someone as a kind of as an agent in New York who helps me on some really targeted things. My wife helps me with some admin and a lot of the accounting stuff. I also have an accountant. I've got my buddy who's just over there on his first trip from Australia visiting me, who still helps with some things in Australia that the time difference actually makes it really difficult. But we worked together for years. And I know he can do that. I can just throw it and not even need to check in to make sure it's been done. That's, there's no one size fits all for me so far. But to answer your question, I've just put up a job ad like anyone would, said what I'm doing without mentioning the name, and, you know, tried to pick the best candidates that way.
Yeah. And that's part of the challenge, right? Especially as you guys become, you know, you guys are well-known photographers, and as you become more and more well-known, like Valerie, you managed to find somebody in the industry to help you. But Matt, you hit on the head with not wanting to hire, say, fans per se. So it's, you know, as you, I would imagine, as you guys get more and more successful, finding someone who doesn't know you, you know, that wants to then, pick, you know, chip in and help you, that you can just pay to do the work, becomes more and more challenging, right?
And you get what you pay for, you know. To me, that's important, and I think it's baby steps too. You know, I didn't just start giving her 10 tasks, you know. I started with one, and then I said, okay, tell me when you're at 5 hours, 10 hours, 15 hours, you know. It's really, because I don't know how long it takes somebody else to do what I can do. And so you want to make sure, you know, if you're paying someone well, you want to make sure that you're getting your money's worth. And so I think but it feels good every time. I feel like, okay, I'm giving one more thing, and it's just really the beginning stages. It just feels really good and liberating. So
yeah, I envy you.
I'm feeling inspired.
Yeah, I want to. Me too. I want to get there. All right, guys, let's switch gears. So I sent you both a list of topics and tangents that I want to go through, and one of them is I think it's really critical, and it's. I title it Balancing Feeding Your Creative Hunger While Keeping Food on the Table, right? So you guys are both creative people. You, and especially Matt on your side, you're teaching people about gear and more of the technical side. How do you balance your own personal creativity and personal projects with training other people, right? Because when you go on a workshop, Valerie, I remember when I went on your workshop, you didn't have time to eat, let alone... you know, hang out and shoot. Like, I'm going to go do some shots by myself and build my portfolio. Now, Valerie, start with you. How do you manage and balance feeding your creative self versus, you know, keeping money in the bank?
Well, you know, I mean, when I'm on workshop mode, I mean, I shoot with my students all day long, but yeah, I'm not expecting to get my best shots during workshop hours, because if I see something and I'm hanging out with one student on a one-on-one part of the photo walk, then I'll give them the shot. I'll point something out. But actually occasionally I get some pretty good shots on workshops, but I'll walk the extra 5 or 6 miles before or after workshop. You know me, I can walk, you know, all day and all night long.
Yeah. So the phrase energizer.
I'll add a few miles just for me after or before workshop.
Yeah. Valerie, the phrase energizer bunny comes to mind when I remember your workshop. Like, you had people on your workshop, they were like, this is fantastic, but where does she get all this energy from? We crisscrossed, I think, the entirety of Paris. You know, I mean, we passed the Eiffel Tower at least 3 times.
And the thing is, as the instructor, you know, when the students spread out for an hour and then regroup and then spread out, regroup, I go like this, you know, like I do it 3 times more miles than they do. And it's actually really funny to see the, you know, the itinerary on my phone at the end of the day.
Oh, the map?
Yeah, the map.
Yeah. It's so crazy. Yeah, no, that's a good
stuff. But yeah, I do work on personal projects too. I'm working on humanitarian projects at the moment too. So I really try to, I mean, I think feeding my creative soul comes first, no matter what, because I can't communicate the passion and the vision if I'm not feeding my creative self first. So that's always number one priority. And I don't work for clients. I shoot for me only. So I'm at a good spot. Yeah. Where I only have to shoot for me.
Yeah, and that is a good spot to be in. Matt, what about you, man? So you're creating training materials, you're doing workshops, you're streaming, you're a content creation machine and educator. I mean, you even got an audiobook on your site, right? So how do you keep the fuel or the coal coming in to generate and stay enthusiastic about photography when you're doing all this stuff that's kind of, you know, on the training side of photography versus just for the pure art of it? How do you stay inspired?
You know, taking a step back, thinking about what might be useful for people listening, I've found that it's easier for me to just separate it out, to have, when I'm leading a photography tour, say Ethiopia or Japan or Iceland, if I get some great shots, that's great. But, you know, people are paying me to lead them. Me helping them, you know, as Val was saying, me helping them get the shot is more important than me getting the shot. So that's my priority. And basically, my approach going through has been to just do my own thing. Some things, you know, separately. So some things I the public knows about, that I shoot some books and I have some different projects and interests. And then I also shoot and do my own things that they may never see, because that's sometimes you need to just segregate some things out, especially when you've got, you know, commercial partners and that kind of thing. But now I'm in such a fortunate position where I'm going to all these phenomenal countries by design to shoot and take people to places that I personally find fascinating. You know, it's not the same as, it doesn't have to be super popular commercial, because I only need 12 people who are interested in seeing the same remote festival in Peru or Namibia as I am.
Yeah.
And then just being there is already, you know, a huge win for me. And then if I can add a couple of days before or after the tour to do my own shooting on top of that, then fantastic. But basically, what I'm working on is being able to pull focus and say, so right now, my job is to be the tour leader or the workshop conductor or the this or the that, and trying to find a few hours a week to be the husband and the son as well. And then when it's my time, then, you know, I go all in on that.
Yeah. Well, great answers from both of you guys on that. Okay, let's switch gears and talk a little bit about gear, right? And Valerie, I know this is your favorite topic of all time. Yes.
I'm all about the gear.
You're all about the gear. All right. So, and I say that tongue in cheek for folks that may not know Valerie. Valerie is and not to put words in your mouth, Valerie, but you are not anti-gear. In fact, you love your Fuji gear and you are, you know.
I'm a gear minimalist, you could say.
You're a minimalist, right? Yeah. I'm trying to avoid the word curmudgeon or Luddite, right?
Oh, thank you. I missed you, Frederick.
I'm trying to pick the right words here, but it's great because you're like, when you were coming on TWIP a lot, we were, you know, we would go down these rat holes of like, oh, this new lens came out and it has this coating on it, so it's much better, or this new camera that's got one more megapixel than the last one. And I could just feel your eyes rolling into the back of your head, you know, as we geared out on this stuff. And you're rightly so, you're an artist. So you don't obsess over the paintbrush, you obsess over the painting, right? So, you know, and Matt, I'm going to throw this at you too, but Valerie, tell us, you know, how do you manage that though with your workshops? So you're doing workshops and I'm sure people come on and they're like, you know, what do I need to bring with me and which lenses do I need and all this stuff. How do you manage expectations on a workshop?
People can come with just a phone, and that just happened a couple weeks ago in Paris, or they can come with the most expensive Leica, and it really doesn't matter. One is not going to take better picture than the other necessarily. Actually, I think the less gear they have, the better they're going to be at seeing. So I always encourage them to come with just one camera, one lens, to have some backup in case something gets lost or stolen or broken, but that's it. Super minimal. It's really about seeing, and whatever they shoot with, I really could care less, honestly. Yeah.
One camera, one lens. See that?
Yeah. Well, mine is attached, so that takes care of the problem.
Yeah, you can't even take it off. I love it.
That's right.
All right, Matt, I have a feeling you have a slightly different tack and take on this, because looking at your website, you know a little bit about gear. So how do you manage that?
And let's just take a moment to look at our backgrounds. You've got a drone and one camera. Valerie's got, you know, 10 cameras back there. I'm the minimal guy.
They all the
you
same.
Are. You are. Hey, but that drone back there hasn't flown in months, so.
No, I mean, I don't disagree with anything Val said at all. You know, it's a phenomenal image. Rewind. I've never seen an image that moved me where my draw hit the floor, where my first, second, or third thought was, I wonder what camera it was shot with. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. What's the metadata?
but having a YouTube audience, a lot of my audience really do care. And it's so funny that I'll sometimes share a photo and people know that at that time I have on loan a Hasselblad and a Leica and a this and a that. And they're guessing, did you use this combo and what settings? But it was a phone shot. And so much of what we share on social media, you can't see that anyway. Was it on a 50 megapixel, 100 megapixel, 400 megapixel camera? On Instagram, you don't know. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But, and I think this is what Frederick was hinting at, I'm a total gear whore. I've been a gadget collector my whole life. My nickname at college was Inspector Gadget. I always had the latest phone, the latest this or that. I got a wardrobe full of cameras and lenses, and I love them like I love, it's like my own room full of sculptures and art.
Yeah.
But because, you know, I'm using stuff and I'm reviewing stuff for YouTube, I took a Leica SL to Ethiopia and I took this to Japan and I'm taking Fujis to Laos next month. So at the end of the day, I still get the shots I need, which tells you something, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. So you're not really tied to any specific camera brand. Okay. Here's a question for you, Matt, because I know a little bit about you. If you're on a desert island, you got your favorite lens and body of all time, and they're not replaceable because you're on a desert island. And you've got your cat with you.
So, she's right here, actually.
Right, and you have to choose between them. Who wins, the cat or the camera and lens?
Oh, that's no question. No question. I wish I would turn my computer, but I think it will bother people. My cat, I've been leaning over to pat her the whole time. There's not a camera in sight. That's a silly one. I mean, first of all, my battery would die within a couple of days, and then I wouldn't be able to use the camera on a desert island anyway.
Yeah, there you go. But you're Inspector Gadget. You're Inspector Gadget. You'd have a solar panel rigged up, and you'd be good to go.
True. I would have to go with my cat.
Good.
She's the best person.
Good answer. Good answer. Cool. All right. Good answers on all these so far. Okay, let's move along back into business. So accounting. And we touched on this a little bit with how do you manage all these spinning plates and all that. But Valerie, you over the years you've refined your business and you know how things work and should work. Are you using like a human to manage your finances, or are you using something like FreshBooks or QuickBooks or some other online service?
No, a human to do like my taxes and all that stuff, and then I do my own invoicing and stuff, but. You know, it's all workshop related, so it's not invoicing clients. So it, I don't know. I guess it is kind of a pain, but it's. I'm so used to it.
Would you ever offload that to the assistant and let her handle
maybe,
all that?
Maybe.
Yeah. See, yeah. Matt.
Baby steps.
Yeah, I know. You let a little bit go at a time. Matt, what about you, man? How are you managing the money flow in and out and all that?
I'm here on a working visa in the States, so I'm kind of terrified of crossing any hard line that's going to get me in big trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have an accountant here that we go to for questions all the time because everything's different. So things that I could deduct or this and that in Australia, they just laugh at me when I suggest it here. But then there's other things that I would be missing out on without their help. Also a bonus, my wife, as on a spouse visa, she's not allowed to work whilst we're in the States at the moment. So she's helping me out more and more with the business. So a lot of the bookkeeping type stuff we do ourselves, that's not true. She does for me by QuickBooks. And then we have an accountant to do all of the, you know, telling us what the lines are. But it's funny, you know, you're trying to grow and rent in Brooklyn is ridiculous. So money matters, obviously, but it sounds like a cliche, but I'm so not driven by it. I just love the game. If I'm negotiating a contract, I negotiate hard and I try to be fair and try and over deliver and all that good stuff. But, you know, then I'll forget to invoice someone for 6 months.
So in other words, everyone, if you're looking to hire someone, hire Matt.
But get a good negotiator.
Exactly. Oh, that's cool. All right. You know, speaking of money flow in and out, there's and I put this in the notes as well. So there's the idea, and I talked about this with Martin Bailey a couple of weeks ago. They were talking about the diversification of income streams, or, you know, not putting all your eggs in one basket so that, you know, if one goes away, you still survive. Valerie, are you like what comprises Valerie Jardin Incorporated? Like, what are your income streams?
Well, I mean, workshop is my number one thing and it's my number one priority. But I mean, I've written a few books now and I started doing webinars, the podcast. But I mean, I could just do the workshops. No problem. I do a lot of the things because I want to be constantly busy and that's how I work better. And I need to be under pressure all the time. So I like to do a lot of things. Like I didn't need to do a podcast and I started, you know, with Street Focus years ago and went on with Hit the Streets. But my workshops were selling out before I even started Street Focus way back when, but it got addicted and I'm loving this other audience on podcasts. And yes, I mean, they also come on workshops, but it wasn't a necessity for the workshops at all. The workshops were doing well on their own, but it's fun. I'm having fun. I'm only doing things that are fun. I mean, if it stops being fun, I stop doing it. So that's one thing that I live by. And I've done a lot of things over the years as a side income stream that got boring. I said, no, I'm going to stop doing that. So the main priority are the workshops. And I do about 10 a year now. And then speaking engagements, which I think are come go together and you never know. I mean, I could break a leg and cancel 2 months of workshops or something, you know, then I know I could always do speaking engagement. So you have to think of those things. The webinars are new and the webinars actually I started as a way to sponsor my podcast.
Oh, nice.
I figured it's so annoying. I mean, I don't want to and I have some podcast sponsors, but I've had a lot of requests of people, of products or software that I have no interest in. And I'm like, I cannot, it's just not me. I cannot talk or speak highly about something I don't care about. And it's so not me. My audience would read right through it because I'm so, what you see is what you get.
Yeah.
And I don't have time to try new products and new software. So I figured, oh, I'm just enough with this sponsorship thing. It's just driving me nuts, but I don't have time to deal with it. And then I said, why don't I just sponsor it with my own brand? So I'm sponsoring the podcast with a webinar series now.
That's cool.
It's great because people are getting education and it's making the podcast
adding to both of them. So tell me about that. So what's in the webinar? Like is it like focused on a particular product or service?
They're focused on it's their educational webinar. So it's a class basically. And it just started. I have the second one going next week. So like one webinar will be how to shoot the best possible silhouettes in the streets. And it's an hour long. People can watch it live or they can stream it later at their leisure. Some will be about, color versus black and white and what should come into that decision and things like that. So they're classes, but they're specific. They're not how to, street photography in general. They're really targeted.
And then
so I have about, 15, 20 that are kind of planned.
What about the marketing of the workshops themselves? How do you get people to know about the workshops, or is it mostly repeat clients?
It's all, they sell out with the mailing lists now exclusively. They never hit social media. Sometimes they will, but they usually sell out from my newsletter. Yeah.
Very cool. And if people want to get on that
some
newsletter,
have sold out like 2 years in advance within 45 minutes. So it's
how do people get on that newsletter?
Never had a chance or something.
Valerie, how do people get on that newsletter if they want to get in the queue?
through my website.
Through the website.
I mean, some popular destination will sell out within an hour, but others, others that are more frequent will take a few months to sell if they're a year in advance, but they usually sell about a year in advance. So like this year has been sold out for quite a while.
Wow. All right, Matt, what about you, man? Diversification of income. You might be the master for, you know, a lot of people I know when it comes to diversification, because you've, looking at your website, there's a lot of streams on there. Mm-hmm. Tell us about how you manage all that and what comprises the Matt Granger financial picture.
All right. So I think a lot of people would expect that if you have a bigger YouTube channel, that itself is a big income stream. The content and the money we get from YouTube, it's a loss. What it costs us to make the videos is more than we get from AdSense. It's their model has changed, and you know, even if we're getting double or triple the views that we were 2 or 3 years ago, the income has fallen, not risen.
Yeah. So, and just for some perspective for people, just for some perspective, that's coming from someone with over 500,000 subscribers on YouTube. So yeah, so that just, wow. It's not like you got, you know, 1,000 people and it's not paying the rent. You got 500,000 plus or more, almost 600,000 people on there, and it's still pocket change. So.
Well, I mean, no, it's, depending on where you are in the world and what your cost of living is, it's a decent amount of money. But being in New York and having people to help you edit things and all that goes into making quality content, the costs are high as well. Mm-hmm. So actually, this sounds a little bit like I'm cynical about it. I started the channel and that was all there was, and I loved it, and the community that's built up, I would keep doing it now, even if everything else was falling to the side. But the value of it in terms of my business now is that it drives, that's my audience. So I don't ever need to pay for marketing. I don't think my mailing list is as strong as Val's by the sound of it. But by mentioning things in YouTube, that sells my downloads or my workshops and tours and that kind of thing. So it's basically where I get my audience. Which is what fuels everything else.
Right.
So I guess the pillars overall of the business are doing client work. So either videography or stills it's all kinds of different things, but sometimes now it's something specific to someone in my kind of position rather than someone just starting in photography, because I'll help some brands launch their products. So people want, someone's releasing a new bag and they want photos and video content to be able to promote that, then, you know, we do some of that stuff as well. I'm doing quite a lot of downloads now. So the title of this video, The Business of Photography, I have a course called The Business of Photography.
Yep.
That's specifically about how to start making money from whatever kind of photography you're doing, and some other smaller downloads as well. Then a big and growing part of the business is running the photography tours. So I do somewhere between 4 and 6 2-week-long tours to different parts of the world each year now. And the same as all of it, you know, there's trends, things grow and then die. So I need to keep building new tours. So this year and next year, it won't be the same 6. There might be 3 or 4 that are, you know, good for several years. But, you know, for example, I did 6 tours to Peru with my partner. And then by the 7th one, we weren't able to fill it. So now we're resting it and coming back in a couple of years with a new program. I'm going to Laos next month to set up a tour, which is a new one, knowing that, you know, one of the ones I run this year probably will get dropped next year.
That's great. I love that. You know, the idea that you guys have built up giant audiences or relatively large audiences, and you use that fuel to fuel these other businesses that then generate income. So Valerie, talk about that. So you mentioned that one of the salient points of what you said was you release a new workshop through your email list and boom, it's filled. How did you get the email list? I know people are watching this. They're like, okay, I want that email list. How do I get that?
No, there's simply people over the past 7-8 years who've either been on workshops, and I have a huge number of return customers on every workshop. On every workshop, I have at least one former student. Sometimes half the workshop is our friends that have been on several workshops. I have people that have been on 10 workshops now in the past 7 years. So, and then they, you know how it is, they make friends and they come back in a different location. And so, and the people who want to be on the mailing list, either they want to keep up with what I do with the books and everything, they sign up for the mailing, because that's how it built itself. It's not huge, but it is a quality list. Mm-hmm. It's like everything else. It doesn't matter how big your social media following, it's the quality of the followers that will matter. Yeah. Right now, it's really difficult to use Facebook for anything, because if you have a page, and I don't have a huge audience, I have like 16,000 people, which is, you know, it takes a long time to build 16,000 followers on Facebook. And at this point, the visibility is under 5%. Wow. It's absolutely ridiculous. If I wanted everyone of my 16,000 followers, and they're people who actually want to follow me, I mean, they liked my page, it would cost hundreds and hundreds of dollars of sponsoring. You know, if I, and I do sponsor things, like I'll sponsor a new webinar and things like that. But for $50, you only get 2,000 views. Yeah. It really, the algorithm have changed so much that it's really difficult to use social media for free.
Yeah. Yeah. The one of the internet marketing sayings is the money is in the list, right? In mm-hmm. the email list. And, yep. And the other one is email is dead. Long live email.
Absolutely.
Email's not going away. Matt, what about you, man? So like I was saying, you've got a large amount of followers on YouTube. I assume mm-hmm. you have an email list and all that stuff. How do you feel your workshops, and how do you sell your courses and all that stuff? Is it just, you just make an announcement and boom, money starts showing up?
Oh, well, I mean, so first of all, I got to say, I don't want it to sound like I just have all the answers, because so much of this stuff every day, I'm just thinking, how the hell am I going to do it this time? So I can tell you what's kind of been working in the past, but I don't just have some formula where I know what's going to happen for the next couple of years by any means.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, if I run a workshop in New York or London, whether it takes, I've never had something fill up in an hour, but whether it takes a week or a month, that they always fill up. Other places like LA, where on paper I have the biggest audience in the States, it never fills up. So there's some little voodoo to that. But yeah, it depends on what the different thing is. So for my tours, I think it's kind of, the model's almost like a wedding photography gig, where if you have clients, you do a really good job, you really take care of people, they tell their friends, and it's like Valerie was saying, now half of our guests are often repeat customers, and I think they're coming as much to see each other as me. Mm-hmm. And my job is to be the best guide I can be, and to be a good host, and, you know, trying to figure out where there's value in a collaboration, because I'm not an expert on every country, so I have to find great hosts in each country. And then if I'm going to partner up with someone else, that really has to add value, you know?
Yeah.
And you have to be ready to change things all the time. People get interested in other things. You just always have to be, how would you say that in English? On the ball? Is that mm-hmm. the right expression?
That'll work.
I mean, all the time. You can't just say, oh, I have that figured out. No, you don't. Yeah. As Matt was saying, I mean, you don't know what's next, and you always have to be evolving and finding new ways to market, because that changes so much. It didn't change that much, you know, 20, 30 years ago. You know, you had a brochure, you'd drop it off at camera stores or wherever. It was all local stuff at the time, or you'd put ads in magazines if you could afford it. But now you're working on a world scale, and things change all the time. Social media changes all the time. You really have to adapt or die. Yeah. I mean, there's no other way.
Yeah. And I think that goes for a lot of industries, right? Especially mm-hmm. this industry, especially if you're an educator and you're educating on, you know, the zeitgeist of the whatever the flavor of the month is, if photographic technique, or if you're trying to instruct on gear. But that's what keeps it exciting, right? Because there's always another layer to the onion to peel back.
Well, it's like photography, you know, if we had it figured out, if we became master at this, it would be boring. You know, we always learn. That's why we're doing this.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's also, that's the great thing about online. There's what, 3-4 billion people online now. If you get a hundredth of a percent of the people who are interested in street photography, that's huge. That's plenty. So it, you know, when you see people coming out, I'm not sure about Val, but for myself, the just being myself from the beginning and doing what I wanted to do, and then having people follow me for that, it's the biggest blessing. So now it's not about fitting some mold or something like that. As long as you're doing, staying true to yourself, that's what people came for. So they're not coming for a character. They're not coming for an entertainer or this or that. They're coming for whatever it is that she offers or whatever it is that I offer. So in a way, yeah, it's keeping up and being aware of what the trends are, but not changing the way you do things to be unrecognizable anyway. If I suddenly, you know, was this cool guy who was always suave and sophisticated, everyone would just wouldn't recognize me anymore.
Yeah. Oh, but you got that cool accent.
And you have
though.
To do it because you love it. It's not something you can fake or people will stop coming.
Yeah.
I mean, you really have to love it.
So I want to, speaking of loving it and workshops, I want to understand a little bit what's involved in one of these workshops, right? Valerie, I know what you do because I've been on one of your workshops. Matt, let's start with you. And I love that. I just noticed your shirt says Freddy's. I love
You're welcome.
So I want to let's start with you. So a day in the life of a Matt Granger workshop, what does it look like?
So the main one I run is a weekend workshop that's about the fundamental of it is it's about understanding light and how light works and how you can use it in, it's for any kind of photography, but we do it around portraiture. So we get in, I bring all the equipment, models, catering, that kind of thing, and we have a studio wherever we are and run through what I think are the key variables to light and a bunch of targeted exercises. And it's great. You know, well, I've done it enough times now that I'm kind of in my groove, but there's always some interesting students and questions to keep you on your toes. But, you know, it's the funniest thing. My mum is a teacher, my aunts and uncles, there must be a dozen teachers in the family. And it probably took me doing this for 5 years before I realized I'm also a teacher, which is something I never thought I would be.
Yeah.
But it's genuinely so satisfying to see someone, and it's got nothing to do with me, but seeing someone at your thing, having those penny drop moments where something that they never got, or maybe I didn't even realize they didn't get it, but when you just see them like, that's why.
Yeah.
Now I got something. It's hugely rewarding, and seeing what the improvement people make from Saturday morning to Sunday afternoon, it's a trip. It's really fun.
Yeah. No, I get that. And I think we, as people that are sort of marinating in this whole world of photography and technique and gear and online and personalities and all that, we forget that photography is one of the fastest and largest hobbies out there, fastest growing and largest hobbies out there. And there's always a crop of new people that have pretty much the same questions. What camera should I buy? And then they, you know, learning Photoshop and Lightroom. And, you know, then they're trying to find their sea legs of what kind of photographer they want to be. Do I want to be a street photographer? Mm-hmm. Do I want to shoot models, landscapes, all that stuff? So, but it's always a series of questions that are very similar, which is why I think workshops are very critical to helping nurture those people, because then they get to mix with other people with the same questions and have someone to bounce questions off of. Valerie, what about you? What's a day in the life of a Valerie workshop?
Well, the weekend workshops are fairly easy to run because I don't take care of accommodations or anything. So pretty much I just show up, I rent the conference room and we all meet. And so, but the week-long workshops are the ones where, you know, I provide hotel accommodations and everything if people want. Now, you know, people can certainly just come for the tuition and some of the meals and find their own accommodations. But, you know, it's providing the real experience, mm-hmm. You know, having them in a place that if they're in Paris, it screams Paris. If they're in Rome, it's really, they know they're in Rome the minute they walk. And you know how people are, they're jet lagged, they're tired, and you want to start them up here and not down here, because it's a lot harder. So you want them to be like, wow, you know, right away, they're in a cool place. It's, they feel good. And then they're ready to just hit the streets. And So the week-long workshop, it's really about seeing photographically and storytelling. So, of course, street photography has a big part of it. And some people just come for the street photography. And then the weekends are mostly just street photography. But, yeah, I mean, it gets easier as you do it, the more you do it, because obviously you learn and you improve things, and you improve things for yourself too. You make things a little bit easier for you. And the size of groups and everything. Now I take about 10 people. It's a good number. And I can run them solo. I like that better than having a bigger number with an assistant in the field, for example. So
oh, I love that. Very cool.
Because nobody wants to be with the assistant, so you end up still doing the same amount of work and paying the assistant.
There you go. There you go. Great, great. This is cool. And I want to remind people, if they want to learn about Valerie, I'm going to pull your website up on the screen now. So I'm showing your website. So it's ValerieJardin.com or Valerie Jardin Photography, whichever one you want to go to. We'll take you to the same place. And this is where they can sign up for your workshops and webinars and all that stuff, right?
Yeah, they'll find the mailing list, and that's where everything is announced first. So and sometimes I feel bad because, you know, I don't think of the time zones, and like my Normandy workshop, which I had put on hold for a few years, I launched it again this year. It's in June. And it sold in 45 minutes at a time where Australia was sleeping. And I know there were a lot of Australians who wanted to be on that trip. So I was careful when I launched the next Normandy workshop to send the mailing list at a time where they would be awake too. It's hard.
Good problem to have.
You know, it's a good problem, but you feel bad because there are a lot of friends, you know, that are in those countries that really want to sign up that I would like to hang out with. And then they never got the mailing list. So, but it's good. So that's where things go first, but they don't all sell that quickly. And I add weekend workshops. I will probably add a couple more this year. And I'll add those a month in advance, and I'll put them sometime on social media, and I'll sponsor. But it always goes on the mailing list first.
So get on the lesson is get on Valerie's mail list.
And I don't sell it. I don't use it for anything else.
Your workshops sell out like a rock concert.
No, I have to make pre-announcements.
You need to
now.
do a deal with Ticketmaster or something. Yeah. Matt, what about you, man? So in terms of like your, you know, we did the day in the life of your workshop. So I'm going to bring up your website right now. So if people want to like schedule and get on your list and, you know, connect with you, this is the kind of nexus of all things Matt Granger.
Yeah, same. I tend to put things first to the mailing list. For my tours, actually, for example, I just today have put up my next Iceland tour. But when I don't have the tour finalized, I'll have an EOI list up where people can register their interest specifically for a country. So I tend to send it to those people first, then a little later to the general mailing list. And then, you know, if it's not sold out, then I'll, you know, put it out somewhere else. But it's great when it just goes to those people who are really, really interested and have registered their interest, because, you know, not all of my audience are in a position to take an expensive tour. So I don't want to be putting up 6 promotional videos a year for that kind of thing. I want the YouTube channel to be more about delivering value to them rather than, you know, being about promoting all the time. Yeah. But yeah, so the mailing list is on the website, and that's on my workshops page. I list all of the tours and workshops.
Yeah. What about, so we were talking about the large YouTube following. What kind of engagement or conversions are you getting from the YouTube base? Like if you put out a video and you're like, hey, I'm starting this workshop and I'm going to Botswana or whatever, mm-hmm. will a 500,000 people will fill that instantly, it feels like, or is that not the case?
I mean, it really depends. So sometimes I miss the mark on what I think is going to be what I find fascinating and what everyone else might find exactly fascinating. But, you know, it's also, you know, the tours are thousands of dollars, and not most people around the world, that's prohibitive. They just can't do it. And then those who are interested in Botswana and have the disposable cash may not have leave at that time of year. So, you know, sometimes they sell out really quickly and sometimes we end up having a spot or two open at the end of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I'll always make it nice and clear what the timeline's going to be and say, so we need, for example, a minimum of 8 for it to be to go ahead and a maximum of 12 and we'll make the call by this date. But yeah, the YouTube is still, it's a really powerful one, but you can't beat a really engaged audience where someone has seen my photos from Iceland. They are really interested. They're waiting to see the next one. They sign up for the list. Yeah, I think my first Iceland did actually sell out in a day or two or something like that. And, you know, for a bigger job like that, that's for me, that was pretty amazing.
Love that. Love that. All right, guys, before we end this, actually, we'll end it on the question. So folks that are watching this live, if you have some questions, make sure you post them in the chat and I'll get to them in just one second. But I have one final question for both of you. Valerie, we'll start with you. So you have a new photographer that comes to you. Maybe let's put some assumptions in place. So it's a talented photographer. They've been shooting for, let's say, you know, 5 years or so. They know their way around the camera. They could probably teach. They understand lighting, exposure, composition, all that stuff. And they're like, you know what? I want to go into business. You know, maybe it's not the workshop business, but they want to go into business. Maybe it's shooting weddings or shooting model portfolios or something, but they want to make money with their camera. What's the advice that you would give that person? Would you say, no, go to Starbucks and work there? Or would you say...
Oh, no, I do think that if you have the talent and the drive, you can make it happen. It's going to be harder than anything else you've ever done to make it to make it in this business, because it is difficult. It's going to take a lot more work than whatever job you're going to leave to do this. But if you want it badly enough, you can make it. But really only get into like workshops, for example. It's a lot harder than people think. Yeah. It's not about travel and da 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 da. I mean, it is a lot of work, and people don't have. And it's hard to sell. I mean, you're for the first years, you're just gonna have sleepless nights. So it people think, oh, I have a large audience, I can sell 10 spots. Well, it's hard to sell 10 spots, no matter how big your audience is. So, and to know that, I may actually do a webinar about that. I'm kind of playing with the idea of a lot of things that people can learn from what I've learned, and do a webinar where people can actually pick my brain about, you know, how to run a workshop. It's on the back of my mind, or write a new book about that. But you have to do it because you love it. It has to come from your heart. It's not something you can fake.
Yeah.
Like, you know, for example, you get into wedding photography. If you do it for the money, you're not going to last. You're not going to stand out. It's going to show in your work. Mm-hmm. You're going to be a very successful wedding photographer if you enjoy every minute of it, or it's not going to last. It's the same workshop. You have to love it. You have to love people and be with people and be extremely, extremely patient.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are really good words. So just to reiterate that, if you get in this game, whatever facet of it you get into it for the wrong reasons, you know, for money or whatever, you're probably not going to last. You may have short-term success, but not sustainable success. Matt, what about you, man? So, same question. You got this person that has, you know, they got reasonable chops as a shooter and they want to start making money. How would you guide them? What's the first step?
Well, this is basically what my business photography course is about. The reality is there isn't what people think of as being the job so often isn't the job. You know, the idea of people that I'm a photographer, so that means I'm taking photos 80% of the time, that doesn't exist unless you're a Nat Geo photographer, but still they're dealing with social media, they're finding contracts, this and that. I'd say, like any business, you need to be clear on what products you're delivering and who to, and how you're going to reach those people and how you're going to sell them. And it is a real risk that if you absolutely love shooting street or models or whatever, as soon as you're doing that for someone else who's paying you to do it, their opinion is as important or more important than yours. If you're thinking of that classic, I take photos, someone pays me for the photos model, keeping your client happy then is more important than keeping yourself happy in terms of getting paid, at least. Yeah. If you get to a point where you're, you know, Annie Leibovitz and you have this huge reputation and you have this style and people come to you for that, that's a different scenario, but you don't get there to begin with. And hearing Val and I talk about how things are now, not that I'm sure either of us think we've made it yet, but that ignores the fact that still half the time is bookkeeping and marketing and cleaning the office and taking out the trash. And for the first 5 or 10 years, it's 90% doing that stuff without a decent income, without the glamorous travel and this and that. So just be sure you're doing it for the right reason and what kind of photographer you want to be, because, you know, neither of us are your typical photographer of what people think of, that you come to me, you give me an assignment, I go be creatively brilliant and I deliver photos for you. That's a small slice of the photographer pie these days, I think.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Those are really good points. And, you know, I think part of this, the underlying DNA of the conversation, is you got to love what you're doing and do it for the right reasons if you want to be sustainable at it. And the interesting thing about being alive today and having all these resources available to us is a lot of the stuff that we do, including this very show and this stream right now, and Valerie, your podcasts, and Matt, your YouTube channel, none of this stuff was possible, like, you know, a decade ago, or, you know, so the tools that we have, the email list applications like MailChimp and AWeber and all those things, the software to do live streams like this, the booking software, all that stuff is there for you, but it's like in a constellation. You got to figure out what sequence to put them in for you, because Matt's and Valerie's constellation or sequence is not going to match what yours is, right? So you got to figure out what your formula is to make you happy. And at the end of the day, what do you want to be making? How much money do you need to make in order to be happy? And then solve for that. Okay, yeah. Well, I love doing street photography. I want to do workshops. I feel like I have the chops to teach someone street photography. So I need to make this much money to make my mortgage and pay all this other stuff off. Therefore, I have to have this many people and book this many workshops. Can I do it? No? Okay, so how do I get there?
Just that breakdown will put a lot of people off, but it's an important conversation to have, that maybe for a lot of people, keeping your job that pays well and takes care of the family and then having your weekend and evening passion and hobby being photography, there's nothing wrong with that. There's amazing hobby photographers creating awesome work. You don't have to have that badge of being a full-time professional and that's how you generate your income to be a great photographer.
Yeah.
I think that's the biggest misnomer. The difference between a hobbyist and a professional isn't the quality of your work. If anything, it's the quality of your business, you know, acumen.
Yeah, no, I agree. And the dirty little secret on the underside of that is, I don't know if you guys, there's a couple of books that I've read. I'm big fans of. One of them is Think and Grow Rich, and one of them is Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And I forget which one. I think it's in Rich Dad, Poor Dad, but it talks about how the holy grail for the guy that's stuck at the 9-to-5 job, not so much, you know, happy about his job, dreaming of doing his hobby as a full-time income, because if I can just, I'm building ships in a bottle at night, and I'm the most happiest when I'm building ships in a bottle. When you make the jump to building ships in the bottle full-time, you start hating it. And now you're like, well, now I didn't know all this was involved. I got to have an accountant. I got to do this. I got to do that. And people are knocking on my door all the time. You have to be able to love what you're doing along with the other overhead that comes along with it, right? So, all right, guys, let's take some questions. There's a lot of questions coming in the chat. Chris Berry is our community manager, holding it down in the chat room. Thanks, Chris. First question is from, let's see. Wow, we've got some questions coming in. I guess this one's from Chris. He says, what did you envision your business would be at the beginning, and how is it different? You want to take that? So, yeah, Valerie, why don't you take that? In the beginning, you know, how did you envision your business, and how has it evolved over time?
Well, I started out shooting for clients, so it wasn't until, you know, I had raised my kids and I feel that I could actually live my dream of shooting just for me and teaching that I quit my commercial photography business. So it was always in the back of my mind. So I did build my audience in order to achieve that, because you can't just start selling workshops with no audience. So yeah, you have to build it by doing a lot of other things like writing and things like that. Mm-hmm. Writing is a big part. And then build your audience. People have to come for you. They don't go for the destination. And it's often something that people don't understand. They come for you. So you have to start teaching in a place that makes the most sense. You can't live in New York and start teaching in London. It won't make any sense. Nobody's going to follow you to London. They're sure. going to go with a local. If they don't know you, they will go with you anywhere if they come for you, though. So you have to start in a place. I'm not answering the question.
No, you're good. They're just like, where were you, like, when you started? What did you think it was going to be, and is it that? And
so, for example, when I started teaching in Paris, although I live in the U.S., but to me, I wanted to share my home with people from all over the world. That first year, I could have never sold New York or Rome or anything. Mm-hmm. Even if several years later, when I had a reputation, and you know, it took longer to sell other locations that I wanted to visit. It took longer to sell Melbourne, Australia, and Rome than it did Paris, because I became known for that. So you really have to start where it makes the most sense. And that's, I got that right away. That's why I thought I need to sell a place that, you know, I'm from there and it would make more sense, and then grow from there. So you have to know that you need to build your audience, and then people will follow you in the workshop business, but it's different for everything
that's,
else.
That's so, a good question. Before we get on to the next listener question, that I'm going to throw at you, Matt, the underlying piece of all this, or a lot of what we're talking about, is having an audience and building that audience and then monetizing that audience. If you have no audience, or you have a very small following on Facebook and Twitter, Instagram, etc., how do you go from zero to hero? How do you go from very few people to enough to monetize? And what is the number? Like, is it 100? Is it 1,000? Is it 10,000? Like, how do you do that? Matt, why don't you take that? What do you think?
Again, there's no one size fits all, but I mean, for me anyway, it was following opportunities and refining things as you go. So like Val said, if it's not fun, cutting it out, or things you're not good at or you don't want to be doing, you're cutting that out and you're adding new things in. A lot of people get the feeling that the market's just oversaturated and you can't get a foothold anywhere, but I don't know that there's any market that's so saturated like that. So, for example, I got a friend here in New York, Jacob Bresniak, shout out to him, great wedding photographer. He's only been going a couple of years. He's doing great work. He's getting a loyal fan base. He's doing a lot of landscape stuff on the side, and he's been building his audience over time, and he's just now organizing his first landscape photography workshop/short tour because he's hitting a point that he feels is the critical mass for him. I don't know which is necessarily better, but from what I see, people tend to do one or two, or a blend of the two different approaches. One is they're really great at, they get the game, they get the model, they see what works, and they, to an extent, fake it till they make it. You know, they start having the audience, they do it that way. And then there's other people like, say, Ben Von Wong, who was just getting great and doing great work for a long time before anyone knew who he was. And by the time people realized who he was, he already had this huge body of amazing work.
Yeah.
I mean, both work, both can build audiences, both can be monetized. The difference is that the latter, he's going to leave behind an amazing legacy of just A-grade work, because he got good before he tried to, you know, he learned, he had all the fundamentals down, basically.
Before he tried to monetize it.
Great work before he tried to cash in. Not that he cashes in on it now, but you get my point, I'm sure.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. ABC Have is in the chat, and I don't know the answer to this question, but he says, Valerie, Matt, Frederick, have any of you jumped on the Vero bandwagon? If so, what are your thoughts? V-E-R-O. I have no idea what that is.
It's a new social media platform. I guess it's big with photographers, but it got popular like overnight and it crashed. So I don't know what the status of it is now, but it's supposed to be really cool. So I'm kind of waiting.
Okay, well, I have to check that out.
I dropped Google Plus, so I'm thinking I would have room for a new one possibly. So yeah, I don't know. Have you tried it, Matt? Or
yeah, I do. I have got it. You know, I'm not a raving advocate or anything. It's it seems great in that their model is kind of what I had hoped for. Like you, I find Facebook just sucks for any kind of reach now. Yeah. But if you're not paying for a service, then you're what's being sold, right? So yeah. We're there for advertisers. Yeah. The Vero model basically is that they said they're never going to take advertisers, but at some point they're going to start charging users to use the server. So it's a chronological feed, no algorithm, no ads, so less censorship, basically, imagine if you paid $5 a month for Facebook and then just got rid of all of the stuff you hate about Facebook.
Happily.
A great deal to me.
I'd pay more than that. Yeah.
So that's the idea. And I signed up because at the moment they're saying anyone who signs up early, they will never charge you. But then later as it grows.
Send me an invite.
Yeah. Oh, no invites. It's not like Google back in the day. Really? You can just jump on.
All right.
Also, it's got less compression and stuff. I don't want to slander anyone, but when I shared that I was using it, a lot of people said, oh, you shouldn't be using that app because the management team are dodgy, .. I haven't looked into all of that. I just thought it's a new app, the photos are better, and I like the idea of getting what you pay for instead of being the commodity that's being sold.
You got to make your own decisions about this stuff. Speaking of that, slight tangent on the Vero thing. I'm going to check that out tonight. I feel like I missed the boat on that. But the Facebook has been in the news a lot. Right, with a lot of things that are going on in different areas, privacy breaches and that kind of thing. And some companies have pulled out, like Elon Musk has pulled SpaceX off of Facebook. I think I saw today that Playboy has pulled all of their fan pages and presences off of Facebook. Who knows if this is going to be a trend? Are you guys mired in Facebook? Are you going to stay there? Do you have any plans to leave, Valerie? What do you think?
No, I'm staying. I mean, I only use it for business, and I have great interaction with. Granted, as I said before, the visibility is getting very minimal for pages, and I wish I didn't have a page, but I do. But I love the interaction I get with the few people that are there every day. So I'll stay there.
Yeah, Matt, what about you? Are you sticking around?
Yeah, for now. I mean, every empire falls, right? There'll be a time when it's no longer number one, and then when it's MySpace. But for now, it is number one. There's, I think I have, off the top of my head, less than half the followers on Instagram, but probably 10 times the interaction there. But they're owned by Facebook anyway, so that'll probably go tipped up before long.
Yeah.
But I'm actually the opposite. I use it for business. I reshare things there. It's a touch point so people can get in touch with me. But now that I'm on the other side of the world, it's great for seeing what my friends and family back home are doing. And if they all change to Vero or Google Plus or whatever, then I'll probably go with it because, it is a social network for me as much as a business thing now. I'm careful about how much I share.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It makes sense. All right. Another question is from Ruth Happel. Ruth says, what's the ideal of a workshop group? The ideal size of a workshop group. Who wants to take that?
Well, as I said before, to me, it's 10 is a good number. Mm-hmm. But then I have colleagues and friends who lead workshops like VIP workshop with just four people, which would be awesome, but of course the price is going to be that much more. So, but I think it would be really fun to offer that as well. Really a lot of one-on-one attention. I mean, imagine running a workshop for a week with just four people, how awesome it would be.
Yeah.
So that's something I'm kind of thinking about experimenting. But part of me says, well, it's so expensive already. You know, I think there's so many people who can't afford to go on a workshop, even a weekend workshop, you know, which is just a few hundred dollars, but still. So I'm offering the webinars to reach that audience too. And so part of me said, well, can I make this even more exclusive? Part of me feels bad about it. But, you know, the people who would sign up would definitely get a lot more.
Yeah.
So I think it'd be worth looking into. So of course, the fewer people, the better one-on-one attention you're going to have. I mean, when you have 10 people on a weekend, you don't get a lot of one-on-one attention. You know, you're going to have to split that attention. On a week, even then, you know, you don't get so many hours one-on-one. I mean, you have to ask for it too. You can't be shy. You have to try it. So I would say 10 is good if you're doing it solo.
10. Perfect. All right. Here's the next question. It's from Tanya Olander. Tanya says, the email list is how I found out about Valerie's tour in San Francisco in February. It was awesome. But how do you get people to sign up to the email list? Is it by offering something initially?
Oh, no, actually, I thought about that. Like, oh, I could write another ebook that I said, oh, free ebook with the email list. And I don't really like that bait thing. I'm like, you know, I don't need to. People will sign up if they want to sign up, and if they want to know about the workshop, because they're going to sign up to get the free ebook, and then they're going to unsubscribe after they have the ebook. Like, why do I don't want to deal with that. So they sign up if they want to. So that, I think it's pretty clear. They got on the website and they see that all the workshops are sold out. Then it says at the bottom, hey, if you want to find out first, sign up here. And
that's fantastic. That's fantastic.
And there are hundreds of previous workshop participants that automatically on it too. So
yeah, see, that is cool. But that's, again, the testament to the power of an email list. And slight aside, if you are a photographer and you're considering getting into business, one of the first steps that I would take would be to go sign up for an email service provider, also known as an ESP, like MailChimp, which none of them cost you any money to sign up for. And I think with MailChimp, you only start paying a fee and when you cross, I think, 500 subscribers, which by that point...
Yeah, and it goes up pretty quickly after that.
You're monetizing at that point, though.
Yeah. Then it's $100 a month, but it's worth it. I mean, you need it. So, yeah. But you also, you know, people who buy my books go into my MailChimp email list too. Yep. So, you know,
pretty much everything I do ties someone to one of the TWIP email lists. We don't spam people. We just notify them of things like this. And that's an important thing. If you start building a list, don't abuse that list, right?
That's right.
This is another message, a question from Chris Berry. I'm going to direct this to you, Matt. He says, how do you qualify and quantify the value of a strategic partnership as your online presence and influence grows? So a strategic partnership, how do you say, you know, if someone comes to you and they're like, you know, hey, I want to collaborate with you so I can grow my audience and your audience. What are the deciding factors for you to say yes or no? And do you do this kind of thing?
From time to time, I mean, I guess it goes for any kind of partnership or business proposition. Is it worth it? So I tend to, it just doesn't feel right. So like, I'm not going to start promoting something that I don't think is good or that I don't use for a quick payday. I don't take any quick and dirty one-off deal of, you know, just mention this once. We'll pay you X dollars and then we never need to speak again. I would much rather have a long-term relationship. As big as it is, the photography community is really quite small and you keep running into the same people over and over. So working with a handful of people and having a great relationship, always delivering, always over-delivering, gives you, you know, a passport to move in and out of, you know, different deals much more easily. I kind of go through a checklist though, and it's kind of being refined over the more experience I have. For example, early on, I thought if I, for example, partnered up with either of you, then you have an audience, I have an audience, you have strengths and weaknesses, I have my own, together we'll be stronger. But so often I've found it's not the case, that to the audience, it often seems diluted, that they're not getting the most of either of us.
Yeah.
So now when I'm looking at, say, people write to me now, why don't you come to Ecuador and run a tour with me, or come to the Outback or this or that, I really have to look at it and think, well, apart from that's another slice of the pie that needs to be shared. It's what do they bring to the table? Is it going to improve the experience of my guests or detract from it? And it's just kind of a checklist of trying to balance it out. Do I think it's worth it? So I'm very fortunate now that I'm not going to chase after some little deal just to get a small amount of money. I'm, you know, my rent's paid and I'm overfed already. So now it's focusing on trying to create good content and keep happy customers.
Yeah, that's a good place to be in, because, you know, being in the position of being able to pick and choose and saying, being able to say no and knowing that your family's still going to eat versus wanting to say no but being unable to say no, because, you know, it's a completely different ballgame, right? Here's another question from Ruth Happel. Ruth says, I used to lead nature tours and logistics alone could be a full-time job. How do you balance the mundane details with the more fulfilling aspect of teaching photography? Valerie, you know, or either one of you, go for it.
Well, it's part of the package. I mean, you have to embrace it all. Yeah. And yes, there are times when you're on a workshop and somebody gets sick and, you know, you have to deal with that, although it's, you know, not technically your responsibility, but, you know, you spend a week with people and you have a responsibility, even if they're staying at a hotel, and that's kind of part of what the hotel's going to take care of, you know, but make sure you don't, you know, nobody else is affected by that, and you lead the tour while you still want to take care of that person and make sure they're well taken care of while you're running. So yeah, there is a lot. You have to wear so many hats, you know. I mean, for me, I'm a constant interpreter during my Paris workshops.
Yeah.
When we're at dinner, you know, where I'm translating menus and I'm you know, giving advice on what I have no clue, but, you know, trying to help people out and pick the best thing on the menu, where everybody knows I'm not a gourmet, but, you know, so you do, and it's part of the fun. And, you know, when you're on a workshop, it's the camaraderie, and it's like one big family. And so, I don't know, it's part of the game. It's part of the fun.
Yeah. You got to embrace the good and the bad. And yeah. And be okay with the mundane, but you know, hopefully the good stuff will pull you through. All right, we're in the home stretch now. Let's knock this out. The next one is from Nick DeLooney. I want to make sure I pronounced that right. Lowney. He says, what type of legal entity did you choose for your business? LLC, sole proprietor, for example. Matt, what are you? What kind of business are you?
In the States, LLC. Back in Australia, it's something similar by a different name.
Okay. Valerie, what about you? What did you choose?
I'm an S-Corp.
S-Corp. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And ABC Have also has a question for you, Valerie. Says, Valerie, are you into kids photography?
No, but that's how I started. I photographed children.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Cool.
Outside in the, you know, in the prairie land, when everybody was taking their kids to the JCPenney or Sears, I was photographing kids 20 years ago, you know. You know, and candid situations.
Got it. Cool. All right. Mark Dodd says, any advice for someone who wants to get into photography on a part-time basis? I'm a landscape photographer. Did start doing local art shows last year, but looking for advice on other avenues.
Yeah, art shows are tough. Whenever I go to an art show and I see like 10 photographers in their booth, I wonder if they even break even. You know, right. It seems like people look, but they don't buy. They buy the $10 thing. So
right.
Tough way to make a buck.
Yeah. So if he's looking for advice, what should he branch out into? Should he be selling stock or going a different direction?
Well, I used to sell to make greeting cards with my photography years and years and years ago, and I used to have little home parties with other artists. There'd be a jewelry maker and people selling this and that, and we'd pull our mailing list together, but at the time they were just families and friends, and we'd host parties either morning or evening, and people came from for the sole purpose of buying from us, you know. So we do that over the holidays, and I would sell hundreds and hundreds of dollars of just greeting cards of my photography in 2 hours because people came to buy. So there are many ways you can make extra cash with your photography, at least to support your gear addiction or something. Sure. But it's the small things that people are going to buy. Even at art fairs, you're better off selling the 8x10s than the big canvas prints.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. ABC is correcting me. Said I misread his question. He wanted to know, are your kids into photography, Valerie?
Oh. You kind of turned it around.
That was my fault.
They're both actually quite good at it, but one is a scientist and the other one is more interested in video. So
there you go. Cool. All right. There's a couple more. Let's see. Where'd it go? This was a great question. Oh, this is from Chris Berry. He says, what are the trends and how will you capitalize on them within the next 5 years? I'm guessing photography trends. Matt, any trends you see that people should be keeping an eye on? Like drones or VR or anything crazy like that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, people are saying VR. I personally don't see it getting much traction. I think that, like the last question, it really, you have to look at what are you in it for? So yeah, drones are selling now, but what, Valerie's going to start using that for her street shots? I don't think so.
Yeah.
Or my storytelling videos, then yeah, that's a great tool. But this is kind of a dodge of the question. I don't want to be a politician about it, but the most important thing is just going where the opportunities are and being fluid with it. If you were shooting stock 10 years ago and you haven't changed your business, you're out of business. Mm-hmm. If you're all in on YouTube and doing nothing else, in 5 or 10 years, you're probably going to be out of business. If you're only publishing fine art coffee table books, there's 10 people in the world who are going to make a long-term career out of that. So I think figuring out, one, what your motivation is. So the guy asking about landscape, what does he really want to get out of it? Some people get a rush from having their photo on someone's wall. Some people are really trying to pay the rent with it. And then it's just a normal business decision of what am I selling? Who am I selling it to? How do I get to them? So I don't have all the answers. It's a matter of looking at, okay, this used to be up here and it's dropping off and this is starting to grow. So why is that? I should go more in on that. And is there something broader going on there that, you know, whatever it might be, to try and identify little trends. But in terms of gear, I mean, some things die, some things pick up. I don't know that that's if I weren't doing camera reviews, I don't think that's something that I would bother following, you know, what's working in retail, because I don't sell cameras.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Valerie.
No, can I add something to the listener who does the art fairs? Mm-hmm. You know, one thing, and I wrote an article about that years ago. One thing that people don't think of is that they want to, like, they live in Maine, for example, and they're trying to sell their photos of Italy or Kenya or whatever. It's not what sells. They're going to sell their local stuff. And that's what people are going to buy. And they're not going to sell buy photos of places they've never been to. They're going to buy local landmarks, local sceneries. And I know several photographers who've changed their approach and have sold a lot more locally that way.
Yeah. Perfect.
That's great.
Perfect. All right. One final question in here I'm going to take, and this is a perfect one to end on, I think. It's from ABC Have, and ABC Have says, my family are hoping to take our first overseas trip later this year. Where do you recommend? Perfect question for you guys that have been on every piece of land on the planet, right? So we'll take it individually. Matt, why don't you go first? Where would you recommend someone go on an international adventure?
That's so tough. That's like asking what's the first camera should someone buy?
Totally.
What are they interested in? What's a surefire you can't go wrong place? I'm going to cut Val's grass here for sure. if I know nothing about the person, what they're interested in, where I know he or she hasn't been overseas before, I don't know anyone who's been to Paris and didn't love it.
There you go. There. All right. Including me.
I would agree.
Including me. I love that. Valerie, you can't pick Paris because you're from there. It doesn't count. That's like me picking, you know, California. So,
you know, it's true. It would all depends. I mean, they have kids who are younger than kids and so forth. I mean, it's just, but wherever you go, you know, try to see too much. Just focus on one city or one region. Don't try to do the American way of seeing, you know, six European cities in 6 days, and then you go home and you don't remember what was where.
Right, right.
Just spend your time, get lost on purpose in the neighborhood and live like a local, but don't try to hit all the landmarks. You're not going to see anything.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, so go, like, basically you're saying focus.
Yeah, just stay focused. Just stay, you know, just don't try to see too much.
All right, let's end the show right there. You guys are fantastic. Thank you for sticking in there and doing this. Valerie, where should, if people, we've already said it, but let's reiterate, people want to connect with you, get on your list, sign up for a workshop that's opening in 2020, where should they go?
ValerieJardin.com, ValerieJardin.com, and they can listen to Hit the Streets every Thursday. And I kept the Thursday. See, I never missed a Thursday.
Perfect. And that's you can sign up for everything at your website, right?
Yeah.
Awesome. Cool. Thank you so much for coming on, Valerie. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, Matt Granger, what about you, man? Where should people go to connect and sign up and buy and all that?
Nice and simple. It's just my name as well, mattgranger.com. At the workshops page, you can do everything. Sign up to the mailing list, and then my upcoming tours and workshops and downloads, they're all listed there. So you can check it out there, but YouTube's good too.
Perfect. Awesome. Thank you guys for coming on. You guys are fantastic. Please come on again. This has been great. I love chatting with both of you. Yeah. And to the listeners and watchers of this show, if you want to keep up with This Week in Photo, obviously head to thisweekinphoto.com. You'll find all of the shows that we do, and all of our efforts are over there, including TWIP Pro, which is our new community. You can head over to twippro.com to sign up for that if you like. And I think that's it. With that, it is time to take that lens cap off.
This is TWIP.